Salam, dear listeners. Welcome to this week's afternoon satsang. As you can hear in the background, the beautiful carols which are being played shows us that it's the Christmas season, so it's wonderful to be back with you. And on this beautiful Thursday, which also happens to be the Christmas Eve day, so we begin by offering our most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And before we talk a little about the Christmas season and the Christmas air which is engulfing Prashanthi Nilayam for the past 1 week, and it's going to peak today and tomorrow, I invite Brother Arvind to join me. Sairam Arvind.
Sairam Prem, really it has been a fantastic time in the sense that, you know, if we take one aspect, there are multiple aspects, but let's take up this aspect of decorations. Just one look at Kulwant Hall, and it doesn't feel like Kulwant Hall. It is like some Gothic cathedral. It's amazing, it's mind-blowing, it's fantabulous, fantastic. I don't know, I just run out of adjectives because the first time I saw it, it just took my breath away. And I'm sure that our Facebook team has shared a few pictures that have been taken of that. So those of you who are not able to be here at Prashanthi for this Christmas, you can see it on Facebook or during the live streaming today evening and tomorrow, you can definitely watch. It is so beautiful. It almost feels like, you know, Jesus is going to take birth today. It is magical. That is the one word I'm searching for.
Absolutely. You know, there's one thing which I, especially the Christmas season, which reminds me is, agreed that we are living with a spiritual master, and, you know, the focus is spirituality. But never a festival was only about the message and only about the, you know, the essence, the content and the hammering. Otherwise, every festival would have been only Swami's discourse. But Correct. Swami ensured that, you know, when you are celebrating something in Prashanthi Nilayam, you get gratified completely. There is, you know, Christmas, as you said, such beautiful decorations which, you know, thrills your heart. Then there is such beautiful music which, you know, draws you within. And then Swami does not leave out, Swami says that, you know, you enjoyed all this, but you have to look at the message. Because that's the whole point. The whole festival is here to remind you of something. And that Swami does, in a brilliant discourse all through these years. You know, if anyone were to just take these Christmas discourses and see, it's a completely different insight into the message of Christ. The way He has given, and the way Swami takes some of these Sanskrit terms and says that this is what Jesus was talking about. This is what He embodied. When you see that, you see the Upanishads coming alive in Jesus' life. You can see what Jesus lived in the message which Swami gives on probably a non-Christmas day discourse. It's all one and the same, and I think it's so beautiful. That's why every festival in Swami's presence, be that Christmas, Diwali or Sankranti or even festivals of the Islamic faith, you always find that it's complete in all sense. There is everything to enjoy. At the same time, you know, the message is not lost.
The beauty of the way Swami has made us celebrate these festivals is that He makes us see the common uniting thread among all these festivals. At the same time, He doesn't, as you said, He doesn't restrict us to just focusing on the common thread so that we miss out the variety that exists. Absolutely. In the celebration. So the variety of the celebration is coupled along with the common thread that is uniting all these. That is how He makes us see the unity in diversity without, making any compromise on celebration of the diversity. The unity that we are able to see that makes us celebrate this diversity even more, because it finally feels like all this belongs to us. Really, I am as thrilled, excited, joyous and feeling wonderful as any devout Christian anywhere in the world would be. And all that is just thanks to Swami. You were mentioning how Swami would draw parallels, you know, explain Upanishadic and Vedic statements with respect to Jesus' life to show the unity. See, today is our Ramkatha fortnight. Today is the first part of our Ramkatha fortnight, and we are discussing Hanuman. I was just thinking how, you know, both Hanuman and Jesus are also united in the sense that when Hanuman was asked, "Who are you?" he said, he started with, "At the level of the body, I am this. At the level of the mind, I am this. But at the level of the soul, I am one with Rama. At the level of the body, I am like a servant of Rama. I am serving him. I am doing his bidding. At the level of the mind, he is my master. He is like a parent, and I am like He's a part of him.
A spark of the divine.
I'm a spark of the divine. Right. He is a parent from which the spark has come. But at the level of the Atma, there is no difference between him and me. If you look at Jesus' life also, that's how it is. When he's asked who he is, the answer varies. First he says, I am the messenger of God.
Then he says, I am the son of God. And then finally he says, I and my father are one. Absolutely. And in fact, when Jesus says, I am the messenger of God, in many ways, that's the first task that Hanuman gets, right? To be the messenger of the Lord. And in many ways, as you said so beautifully, that kind of a progress which Jesus showed in his message, saying that, you know, this is how each one has to progress. Because that's, in many ways, when you look at the message of Jesus and the way Swami has given it, you see how much we have misunderstood. There's one statement which Jesus Christ makes. He says, I am the way. Okay? And it is misunderstood in so many ways by saying that this is the way and
this is the only way.
Only gate and all that. But actually what Jesus Christ was saying is, look, if you want to reach the Lord, you have to pass a phase which is like mine. You know, you will have to be like me. You will have to be as compassionate as me. You will have to be as sincere in devotion like me.
As sacrificing, as forbearing as me.
As Swami would beautifully say in almost every Christmas discourse, he says there are three words which define Jesus. Mamata, Samata and Chamata, he says. You know, love, equanimity and then forbearance. And Jesus was saying that if you don't go through this phase where you become, embody these three qualities, you can't reach my, you know, Lord. And very, very truly, that's the very same hero we're going to talk about, because as we said, so many beautiful parallels between Hanuman and Jesus, because the entire New Testament is about the messenger of the Lord. It's not about the Lord, it's only about the messenger. And the Sundarakandam is nothing other than that. Here is the messenger of the Lord. Here is the, you know, the, as Hanuman says, Dasoham, the Dasa of the Lord becoming the hero. And that's why Sundarakandam is so special, as we've spoken so much about, and we are right in the middle of that.
And again, it is a coincidence, if I can use that word, that we are talking about the messenger of God who told that he is a spark of the divine, and finally he said, I am no different from Rama. The same things that Jesus said, coinciding with the festival of Christmas. It is so beautiful, and once again we can just offer our gratitude to Swami for making this coincidence happen that thrills us, that fills us and that delights us. So dear listeners, with that brief introduction, we will be continuing from where we had left off last time. But before we do that, as always, as we do before the beginning of any Ramkatha Satsang, we start by remembering the sweet, nectarous name of Lord Sri Rama, after which we shall proceed with the story.
Sri Rama Rama Rameti Rame Rame Manorame Sahasranama Tatulyam Ramanama Varanane Ramanama Varanane
Yes, dear listeners, as always, we begin by offering our most humble pranams at the Lord, lotus feet of our Lord and at the feet of Lord Hanuman, who is believed to be present every time the story of the Ramayana is spoken about, is thought about, is glorified. And it's so beautiful that today we are going to continue talking about this phenomenal hero. You know, if you go to North India, if you go to, in fact, even in Andhra Pradesh, it is very, very difficult to find even one town, one village, or one small settlement which does not have an Hanuman temple. Even more common than a Rama Lakshmana temple is a Maruti temple. Especially if you go to North India, UP, Bihar, Madhya Pradesh and Maharashtra, you'll almost every temple I mean, every village will have. Even in the Satchitra, you will have that. You know, there's a Maruti temple in Shirdi. There's a, wherever they go, there will be a Hanuman temple. You know, it's such an inspiration that here is a devotee who has raised himself to that level.
No, when you speak of that, absolutely an unrelated subject. During the convocation, we had the chief guest from Japan. I forget his name. Right. But along with him in the delegation was Mr. Suzuki also, right, who is the CEO of the Suzuki Corporation. And the Suzuki Corporation, in collaboration with the company in India, have come out with the car Maruti Suzuki.
Right.
So he was very amazed when he got to know that Maruti is the name of Lord Hanuman, and that there is a 65 feet statue of Lord Hanuman in Puttaparthi. He requested whether he could view that statue.
Okay.
And that's why the entire Japanese delegation ended up on top.
Wow.
And on the social media also, this photograph, right, was doing rounds of Mr. Suzuki doing aarti
to Maruti.
And you know what? So beautifully, Prem, that on the hilltop, mm-hmm, it is not put as Hanuman.
Okay.
The nameplate there reads Maruti.
Wow.
65 feet. So it was amazing and thrilling. So when you just said Maruti, not only in North India, here also Swami has placed Maruti as a
absolutely
ideal for all.
One thing is we worshipping Lord Hanuman and putting his temple everywhere. I mean, what better fulfillment for a devotee when the Lord himself comes and says, you know, the biggest statue in my Puttaparthi will be yours. The highest placed statue will be,
you know,
yours.
And Hanuman is above Krishna, above Shiva,
right,
above Zoroastra, above Jesus in the Hillview Stadium.
Right,
and
right,
it's almost like the devotee is being put at the crown jewel.
Absolutely.
Over the Lord himself.
Saying, you know, those days, 65th birthday was a real important birthday. And of course, we have gone through so many 70, 75, 80, 85. But that time, 60th and 65th actually drew, I think, the largest crowds for that time. Puttaparthi was never used to that kind of crowds. Imagine for Swami's 65th birthday, which was so special, Swami says, let's put a 65 feet statue of Hanuman. You know, how beautiful is this relationship between Lord Hanuman and his Lord, who is our Lord?
I think possibly next week, as we discuss Hanuman, we shall also discuss the story of how that statue came up.
I think
that
would be beautiful, right?
Yeah, we'll gather a little more details and it will be exciting to relive that.
Exactly.
Coming back to where we were in the story, we had just discussed how Hanuman overcomes a sattvic obstacle, a rajasic obstacle and a tamasic obstacle. The sattvic obstacle being Mainaka Parvat, the rajasic obstacle being Surasa, and the tamasic obstacle being Simhika. How he overcomes them and lands on the shores of Lanka. Now, as soon as he lands on the shores, he is just amazed in seeing those multiple gardens, parks, the pleasure centers. It is reveling in, you know, it's like a partying place. It is so full of that, and he is just charmed at first, because that is so, it's almost looking like it's heaven itself. Everything seems to be paved in gold. But though it looks so beautiful, there are these rakshasas and ogres trolling the place. So Hanuman realizes that he is going to be a stranger if he enters, because there's nobody looking like him.
Right.
And therefore he takes on a small form and he decides to enter the city gates to enter Lanka. And even as he is doing that, he is accosted by a guard at the city gate, a fierce lady, a demoness by name Lankini. She stops Hanuman and she refuses to let him pass through, because that is exactly her job.
Right. And she stands there, and first of all, she's amused by this form she's seeing for the first time. You know, it's a form of a monkey, and probably there are no monkeys in Lanka. And also it is in a miniature size. So she stops and she says, who are you? How did you come here? First of all, it's an island which is covered by ocean on all sides. And how did you land up here? There's no way anybody can reach here. Mm-hmm. And she kind of asks, do you mean to say that you've jumped across the seas and come here? And how dare you? Nobody enters here. But you know, the way Swami writes, it's so beautiful. Mm-hmm. Like Hanuman is casually walking, you know, least bothered about these questions. And like, as he's just strolling into the garden.
Exactly. You know, when you're reading this, the impression, the image that comes in your mind is of what Swami says, the elephant is not affected by the barking of dogs.
Right.
But here it's the opposite actually, because Hanuman in size is so small, Lankini is a dauntingly big figure.
Yes.
And yet, Hanuman is walking with the panache and confidence of an elephant, while Lankini seems to be barking with the ferocity of a dog.
Right. And in the way Swami writes it, Hanuman walks casually, dragging his tail along, you know, which is trailing behind in the ground. See, he's like least bothered, and in fact, it's a very beautiful interaction at this particular point, you know. The emotions of a devotee, first of all, fearless, absolutely fearless. You know, when you have the backing, as I was telling somebody, you know, when you know that you have the backing of a minister, you feel so confident. You know, you don't mind breaking the traffic rules, you don't mind getting caught somewhere. You know, the typical thing of, you know who I am, you know who I know, you know I have the number of so-and-so. I mean, when you know the fact that here is Swami who's to take my, you know, who's cover my back. He's there, you know, what should I fear? What is there for me to even hesitate about to, when I'm doing the right thing, when I'm doing it for my Lord? And that is the first emotion Hanuman is showing in this particular part where, in this interaction with Lankini. He's like absolutely unperturbed by her, you know, and she starts yelling, she starts howling at him and she says, stop, how dare you do this?
Continuing with that thought, you know, of fearlessness, I feel the only difference possibly between the minister and Swami would be, when it comes to Swami, the intention counts. So you can't hoodwink the Lord the way you can hoodwink a minister who is backing you. So Hanuman's intentions are definitely pure. And talking of fearlessness, this was a thought that has struck me many times, that if one has to truly be fearless, one actually has to be desireless. One should not have desires of one's own or, you know, like objectives. This is what I wish to do. This is what I want to do. If only one is able to have a single desire, that is, my Lord's wish is my command. That's all. I have no desire of my own. I have sublimated my desire. See, we saw this even in the beginning of the Ramayana where Lakshmana cries and tells Rama, why are you telling me to build a hut where I wish? Do you mean to say that your wish and my wish is different? Rama, why do you put me into such suffering? Why do you make me a third party away from you? That is the kind of pangs that Lakshmana suffered. I mean, while any one of us, if Swami says, yeah, do it as you please, we would have thought that this is a way of the Lord reposing his faith in us. That's the way a devotee, a true devotee thinks, and that is how a person who thinks he's a true devotee thinks. That is me and you. So here also, Hanuman has absolutely no desire of his own. And therefore, when you have no desire of your own, there is no fear of disappointment, there is no frustration, there is no irritation, there is no anger, there is a calm, and you have really no fear. Because, you know, the success or failure doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter to you because you are doing the Lord's work. If the Lord wants it to succeed, it will succeed. If the Lord is wanting it to succeed in a manner in which you are supposed to be failing at a level, fine with it. You have absolutely no fear. And I feel this has to be highlighted that Hanuman or any true devotee is fearless, not only because he knows his Lord is backing him, but also because he has no motive or desire of his own. The only desire being that I have to fulfill what my Lord has told me to do. And that also, you know, it is not as if I have to see the result of that action. I am going to put my efforts towards fulfilling what my Lord has said. How it gets fulfilled, what happens is all left to him. And therefore I have nothing to fear. So fearlessness and desirelessness are very, very closely linked and interrelated.
Absolutely. But, you know, just adding another cog in the same discussion which you were trying to bring in for us. There is fearlessness and there is desirelessness. But when you bring in God in that thing, you know, when you're talking about faith, we all speak about faith, you know, I have my faith here, I'm a faithful in this one. But many times we forget that what is important, you know, when you're living in life, we're living in a life where what is most obvious is your actions, is your thoughts, is your beliefs. So if that faith does not express itself as fearlessness, then that faith is actually, you know, as Swami said, there's no unity of thought, word, and deed. If you really have that faith, it will express itself as fearlessness. And the same thing, desirelessness comes because, you know, from this point, Hanuman is thinking, okay, if I die, if that is the choice which Rama has for me, it's acceptable for me. You know, the desirelessness comes because whatever comes from God is acceptable for me. So it is this way or that way, it doesn't matter to me. So I don't desire one more than the other. So this triad of, you know, fearlessness, desirelessness, and deep faith and surrender. I think that is what all of us as devotees are on, you know, forever trying to achieve.
And that's why Hanuman is walking so confidently, and his Lankini, who is so menacing and strong and powerful and fearful, fearsome, she comes approaching him and she says, "You stop, you ugly beast." You see, she is susceptible to anger now. It shows, that is the difference, you know. She, Lankini therefore will not be able to be fearless because she is susceptible to anger, and anger comes only when you are susceptible to desire. If you have no desires, there is no way you can ever get angry. Anger is always linked to desires. So anyway, she is very angry. She calls out, she says, "You ill-fated fool, don't my words fall on your ears? If you go against my orders, you ugly beast." See the kind of words she used. "You will be eaten up. I can chew your bones in seconds." And when none of her words seem to be making any impact on Hanuman, she lunges forward to attack Hanuman. And Swami writes that with his tiny paw, because now Hanuman has become small, with his tiny paw he just turns and gives a blow. And Lankini is thrown to a distance. You know, it must have been shock. It must have been a shock for her to imagine such a powerful blow and such might coming from a creature so small. But then that is what the Lord's grace does. I remember reading somewhere that Agnes Bojaxin, who later became Mother Teresa, when she was small, she broke open her piggy bank and she said that she wanted to start a service home to serve the people of God, whoever needs love. So somebody said, you know, Agnes, I think they would have addressed her as Agnes. They said, "Agnes, with 3 pennies, you can't do much. You can't do anything at all, actually." And her reply was fantastic. She said, "With 3 pennies, I can't do anything. But with 3 pennies and God, there's nothing in the world that I cannot do." And I feel that is what is seen here also. Hanuman might be very puny and his paw is so tiny, and yet his blow is enough to throw Lankini so far. In fact, when she makes a second attempt to attack, he gives her a second blow, which actually completely demolishes her body. Her spirit is freed, Lankini is dead, and from the body of Lankini emerges, is freed actually. Freed a soul, a being that had been trapped in that body as a result of a curse, and that being comes and addresses Hanuman.
Right, and she reveals one incident which happens when Ravana gets his boon from Brahma, because this whole thing about, in fact, there's another sidetrack to it, I'll come to that after this, what Lankini says. Lankini tells him that when Brahma gives him that boon, that, you know, you will become a great emperor, whatever is the boon which you're seeking. And when Brahma is just about to leave, he stops, Swami says, he stops and turns back and tells Ravana, "But Ravana, be aware that one day, a mighty warrior will come to the gates of your kingdom, and he will come in the form of a monkey, and when that monkey is able to, you know, fell your guard at the gate, that is the day your doom begins," and he leaves. And what you tell is, you know, there is a lot of debate which is happening now about contorting Ramayana by speaking of it as a fight between the Dravidian race and the Aryan race. You know, they say the Aryan race is from Central Asia, which has come to the northern part of India, and then you have the Dravidian race, and the entire Ramayana, there were some people in South India who went to the extent of being foolish they started celebrating Ravana because they said he's our king. You know, because Rama was the Aryan prince who came, and, you know, it was the Aryans coming and trying to stamp their supremacy over the Dravidians. So let's not have Ramanami, we'll have Ravananami, you know, whatever, all kinds of nonsense. But, you know, the mythologically, actually Ravana is also from north, from closer to the Himalayas. And it is after he wins all these bones, he wants a kingdom which tells the people around that, you know, here is the king of such authority. So he comes to this island kingdom of Lanka where Kubera has built this beautiful city. The whole city belongs to Kubera. He comes and he snatches it away from Kubera and becomes the king of Lanka. So this idea of here is the South Indian Dravidian king who is Ravana, and, you know, it's, we are so filled with our narrow-minded understanding that we try to fit in an epic as so deep as we go into Ramayana. That's what we are knowing. It's so deep in such multiple levels, so much to learn into our concept of Dravidians, Aryans, things like that.
continuing the story, yeah, she reveals that Ravana is told like that by Brahma. In fact, Brahma even mentions that that monkey that is going to come and, you know, give that blow, it, that monkey will be actually fulfilling the command of the Lord.
Right.
So all these hints are actually given. It is just that Ravana refused to see the hints. It, you know, Swami would mention in the Chinnakatha about how people, as they grow older, they start getting wrinkles on their skin. Then they use some creams and lotions to iron out those wrinkles. Then they start getting grey hair and white hair. They put dye and cover up the hair. Then they start to lose their teeth. They use dentures and ensure that they don't have to give up eating anything that they love. And finally, the day of reckoning comes when they're about to die. They say, "Oh my Lord, what is this? Oh God, what is this? Suddenly I am dying." And Swami says, "No, you're not dying suddenly. All warnings have been sent. You just chose to ignore it." That is what has happened even in Ravana's case. So many warnings, messages, ominous signs, all these occur to him, as we shall see from now on also. It's almost like God is giving Ravana a chance to prepare himself in a manner so that he can receive this as a boon rather than, you know, fight it out and struggle like a Rakshasa. But as they say, Vinashakale Vipreeta Buddhi, when the time of doom comes near, your brain begins to function haywire and it leads you to a path that is even more astray. So, as we shall see later, this news, when it travels to Ravana, that a monkey has entered the kingdom like this, rather than remembering what has been told and trying to mend his ways, he actually decides that it is time to go and try to force and coerce Sita faster into marrying him. That is what Swami means by saying Vinashakale Vipreeta Buddhi.
Right. And the other aspect of this interaction between the Lankini and Hanuman is, you know, the moment the Lankini realizes that this is, you know, this is not an ordinary intruder into the kingdom, because he's that messenger, because as you said, Brahma tells him that, you know, he will not be any ordinary person who comes into the thing. He'll be coming into the kingdom on the order of the Lord himself. So she immediately develops admiration for Hanuman. He says, "My God, you are that person. You are that special person." And Swami says that she starts fondling the place where Hanuman is, you know, given her the first blow. And he says, "Oh God, I'm so honored that I had the touch of somebody who's so special," and all that.
I feel, you know, Prem, in life also, you know, life will land us many blows. Many times we get blows from life. But if only we are able to look at that thing which is dealing us blows as a messenger of the Lord, then, you know, just imagine this Lankini, who's got such blows and who's reeling under the onslaught, who's so angry, is able to fondle the spot where Hanuman hit and then say, "Oh my God, it's so beautiful, so wonderful, I'm blessed that you touched me here." That happens because there's a change in perception. She is now viewing Hanuman as a messenger of God rather than some intruder. So too, I feel, in our life, when problems come and smashes and land blows on us, rather than looking at those problems as intrusions in our lives, if we are able to look at them as messengers from the Lord, come here to deliver some message which we should learn, just like Lankini learnt and redeemed her life, I think we will be able to enjoy even the so-called blows.
Absolutely. And the change, you know, of course we often say this, in the Ramkatha, it happens in one paragraph. Like in the beginning, she's like shouting and howling at Hanuman. And towards, I mean, just this one blow and this recollection of this boon, which, or rather the warning which Brahma has given Ravana, she says, "Oh God, this, you're that special person." And now Swami says, what is Hanuman's reaction to that? He says the same reaction which he gave when she was shouting at him, you know, the way he was walking, absolutely unaffected. Now when the praise is coming, he just walks off. He does not even stop to acknowledge that, you know, "Oh, so, I mean, my coming has been foretold and by so many people." We get so impressed by that, you know.
Yes. You know, personally, I felt this was such a lesson for me, because I have faced a lot of personally criticism as well as praise, and I used to find it very difficult to deal with criticism. So finally, just like Hanuman, I decided that when people criticize, if there's something positive in it, take it. If the person is doing out of genuine concern, try to take it and improve yourself. But otherwise, just like what Hanuman did to Lankini, just walk away without bothering. And I have decided to practice that and I'm successful at that. But you know, Prem, the second part is so tough. You just can't walk with disdain and without bothering when somebody is praising you. It's almost like when the praise starts, you stop, turn back and receive all the adoration, adulation, and then only, you know, proceed towards the task that the Lord has set you upon. You, for that much time when the praise is being showered, you delay the Lord's work. So, it is really, really admirable that Hanuman is able to do it, because I feel personally, with some kind of practice, you are able to train yourself to walk away from criticism. But to walk away from praise, oh my God, that's a totally difficult ball game.
For instance, if you take the life of poet Kalidasa, you know, there is that story where one day he gets this grace from goddess Kali and he becomes a
Vikatakavi.
Right, he becomes, immediately he starts singing the praise of the Lord, composing and all that. It is very easy for somebody like Kalidasa to, you know, credit his talent to God. Because it happened instantly. You know, it was gifted to him. He was a fool and one moment later he becomes a great poet. But why wouldn't it be the same case if a person is born talented and becomes more talented as he grows up? In what way is that talent belongs to him and, you know, somebody like Kalidasa says, no, my talent was a gift. Similarly, when I look at Hanuman, yeah, Hanuman was a hero even before he met Rama. According to the story, you know, we have these exploits of his. He tries to reach the moon and, you know, he's supposed to be so powerful and he's cursed that you'll forget how powerful you are. So he was always powerful. But is his ability to say that, you know, even now if I'm having the strength, it is nothing but the grace of my Lord. Even now if I have a talent, it is nothing the grace of the Lord. I think that is a lesson which is for all of us. Even when it is not obvious that the talent has been, you know, picked up and given to you, to be able to say that, no, even though I've been living with it all this while, this talent is also as much a gift of God as anything else would have been.
I remember at this point in time the experience of one of our alumnus, Mr. T.V. Hariharan. Have we narrated that? Of how, you know, he was a violin maestro. From his childhood he has been playing the violin, and when he joined the college, that was a time there would be this kind of a talent search.
Mm-hmm.
We have this talent search programs even today in college where the freshers are allowed to exhibit their talent. The only difference is those days Swami would physically come to what we call as the old hostel, the East Prashanti, the northernmost point of East Prashanti building, which we call as the old hostel.
Right.
That is where Swami would come and do this talent search program. In fact, Swami had asked, are there no singers, musicians in this batch? And that was when Mr. Hariharan thought that he would just bamboozle and stun Swami with his ability, because he had a magical ability to play the violin. And he says that he played in front of Swami all things that he could imagine. Apparently Swami was not very impressed. He was wondering what is it that is needed to be done to impress Swami more.
Swami listened to him and he was thinking that, you know, he would be the hero of the evening. Swami came and patted him, and apparently Swami said, have you heard of Tyagaraja? Okay, he said, yes Swami. And then Swami just remarked about Tyagaraja. I mean, did not tell him how well he played or anything. He said, Tyagaraja always offered his music to God. And he said, I always do it only for God. And he accepted it as a gift from God and he offered it back to God. And he went away.
In fact, the actual sentence, if I remember right, what Swami said was, Tyagaraja never sat and composed any music.
Okay.
It just came, Tyagaraja just communicated with God. That has become music. Apart from that, he says, actually this Tyagaraja thing happened maybe at a little later date, I don't know. But that day what happened was, even as he was playing the violin and attempting to show off to Swami, he says that in advanced music there's something called Kalpana Swara. In Kalpana Swara you have such mastery over the raga that is being played, that you no longer stick to the script. You just it's like a unplugged version. You just start going alive extemporaneously. You just start playing with the notes because you're a master in that raga. And he said, Swami began to sing Kalpana Swaras of that raga and asking whether he can play. Now, Kalpana itself means imagination. Imagined. So this is what Swami is imagining and telling it out. How is he able to play? And Swami was apparently like, oh, you're not able to do this. that is when he, you know, he says he realized, he had thought that Swami has some level of musical IQ, you know, some music IQ he has. I will stun him with a repertoire that is much greater. He himself got stunned. That is when he realized that how foolish he had been, because his talent is actually a gift of God. If he forgets that, that's not right. In fact, he says he felt that his talent, instead of taking him closer to God, was taking him away from God towards his own ego. So that evening he went and smashed his violin, the violin that he is the champion of, because he said, I don't want to play the violin anymore because it's taking me away from my Swami, it's making me egoistic. But then, you know, as Jesus says, he that humbleth himself will be exalted. That's exactly what happened to Mr. Hariharan also, because a few weeks later, for the birthday celebrations, I think, I don't remember the year, 81, 82, Bharat Ratna, M.S. Subbalakshmi, she had come to Swami and Swami had asked her whether she would be happy to sing. She was delighted. She said, Swami, I would love to sing, but the thing is, I have not got any of my accompanying artists. And for Carnatic music, one of the most common accompanying artists is a violin player.
Right.
Swami said, no, you need a violin player, right? I have a violin player. And Swami comes to Mr. Hariharan and tells him, your aunt has come. She needs somebody to play the violin, you play the violin.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he was thrilled beyond measure. At the same time, he was scared. Thrilled because he was so touched. You know, M.S. Subbalakshmi, not only the legend today, even in the 1980s, she was a legend. She's a legend who has performed in more than 100 countries, and she's a Bharat Ratna. And the same Swami who didn't acknowledge his ability because of his ego, you know, which he realized, is today coming and with great confidence telling M.S. Subbalakshmi that this Hariharan will be accompanying you. That was his thrill and joy. His dread was, what shall I do now? Because I don't have a violin.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a violin. He says, Swami also sent a violin for him, specially in the hostel. Swami understood his predicament and sent him, and that was a violin he used to accompany. So, yeah, speaking of skills and talents, everything is a gift from God. Each one of us have been given different gifts. We should use those gifts only to glorify God, because I don't think there's any other better way that gift can be sanctified.
Right. And at this point, Hanuman enters the city of Lanka because he's taken the form of a small creature. He has creeped into the gates. And what does he encounter there? We'll go into that, but after a short break. And as it's going to be Hanuman all the way, why not listen to a beautiful bhajan on Lord Hanuman? Don't go away, dear listeners. We'll continue our discussion after this bhajan.
Anjana
welcome back, dear listeners. And even as we are playing that bhajan, I think Arvindi was reminded of that little joke about this bhajan we had spoken about in one of our bhajans afternoon satsang, right?
Yes, actually about how when you sing bhajans in the extemporaneous way of adding josh,
alap and
enthusiasm to the
speed,
bhajan.
Four speed, right?
Yeah, there's this line that one day Lanka Bhayankaram.
Right.
So we have the thing that you add Sai to anything, like, you know, Shiva 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 Subramanyam Sai Subramanyam, we just add that Sai, right. Jai in middle, so that one day Lanka Bhayankaram Sai Bhayankaram Sai Bhayankaram. So when you sing Sai Bhayankaram, it means as if Swami is Bhayankaram, because there Lanka Bhayankaram it is.
Right. Lanka was, you know, in awe of Hanuman's valor.
Huh.
Now you're saying that Sai Bhayankaram Sai is so scary.
Exactly. So I remember, as you said, we are reminded of that. Yeah. So now, as Hanuman has entered Lanka, this is a situation I think all of us devotees feel. We keep receiving such mails at Radio Sai, and I personally also get such requests, you know, that Sairam brother, I have been transferred to Russia in such and such a place. Are there any Sai devotees there? I'm in New Zealand. Is there a Samiti there? Because somehow we feel that connecting with the Sai center or Sai Samiti in Canada, US, Australia, anywhere is equivalent to getting a family, or because that is how beautiful the bond of love with the Lord is. It's almost like that, you know, Hanuman has entered a foreign ground and he's thinking, now where shall I make my first contact? With whom shall I make contact? Because everyone is so different.
Just as you were saying about that, just this morning we had one of our brothers from UK who came in. You know, he was narrating about this beautiful thing. He's a surgeon in the UK and he was saying that he has this weird way of connecting with Swami when he needs it the most. He said when he does his surgeries, he plays Swami's discourse.
Okay.
He said, see, it's, I mean, whoever feels, I feel so tranquil when I'm doing that, and I need that tranquility maximum when I'm working on a, you know, doing a surgery on a patient. He said, when he was once playing, I mean, he's had it many times, you would have the paramedical staff and the nurses and all that. Once when he was doing that, one nurse said, hey, that's Swami's voice. And he was surprised, because he's been working with his nurse for quite a few months or years, but he never knew that this lady knew Swami, and they got talking, and he realized that this particular nurse had worked as a nurse in our Whitefield hospital.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, she had received sari from Swami's hand. He said she was so thrilled that, you know, to listen to Swami's voice in some, you know, she's in London and she's come away from Puttaparthi. She said, sir, I always feel so bad why I left Puttaparthi. And today I feel so happy listening to Swami's voice in the surgery.
So that must have been Radio Sai then.
Yeah, exactly. He was actually telling us that only, you know, in what all ways you end up connecting people.
Just makes us feel humble and, you know, let us not pause over here, because like Hanuman, let us continue strolling towards the Lord's mission. So Hanuman is searching, and at that exact point in time when he lands on the roof of one building, he hears the name of Hari, that is Vishnu. Somebody is constantly doing Hari Namasmarana, and he wonders, what is this? Who in a place like Lanka also, the Lord's name is being chanted, so he's so thrilled. It actually gives him more courage. And he goes, and when he locates the house, he feels that the man of this house, you know, appears to be very devoted and good person. So I think he is the best person to ask as to where Sita is. And with that he enters. Before entering the home, he doesn't want to enter like a monkey. So he changes his appearance to that of a Brahmin, a devout Brahmin himself. And he enters the home of Vibhishana. This happens to be the home of Ravana's second brother, which is Vibhishana.
Right. And as you said, he enters...
Second brother, or he's the youngest brother? I think Vibhishana...
Right.
I think he's the youngest brother. I'm confused now. Okay. We will clarify that, dear listeners.
The other brother is, of course, Kumbhakarna, who is unavailable most of the time because of, you know, the boon that he takes that he should be allowed to sleep for 6 months. But Vibhishana is the, you know, the pious brother of Ravana.
I think he's the second brother.
Right. And Hanuman is so surprised that, as you said, he's walking into this place where, you know, the nameplate has, you know, like how we have in our homes, Om Shri Sai Ram, or, you know, Hari Om, things like that. So he finds the name of Lord Hari inscribed in the very entrance of this palace. He goes inside in the form of this Brahmin, And Vibhishana treats him like how a Brahmin has to be treated. That's another surprise. Because here is somebody who is offering the hospitality which you don't expect from the Rakshasas.
Mm.
He says, I don't know who you are. There is no way a Brahmin can walk into Lanka and in fact walk into a palace like this. So whoever you are, you've taken the form of a Brahmin. So you deserve my respects. He prostrates in front of him. And I think Hanuman asks him, who are you? I'm so surprised to hear the Lord's name in Lanka.
Before that, Hanuman also introduces himself.
Yeah, no, Hanuman introduces himself finally.
After Vibhishana says, you know, Vibhishana is actually bemoans. He says, you know, I am Vibhishana and sadly I am the brother of Ravana. It's my fate that I have been born into a family, a kingdom, a place where I am not allowed to carry out my sadhana of chanting the Lord's name with all confidence and, you know, publicly without any fear from anyone. So I am that wretched soul who is caught up like this over here. Hearing this, Hanuman becomes very happy because all said and done, this is a devotee of Rama. This is a devotee of the same Lord. Just like that lady there felt thrilled seeing the doctor who is listening to Swami's discourse. So Hanuman then says that, you know, I am a servant of Hari. The same Hari whose name you are chanting, which you are reciting. I am the servant of that Hari. My name is Hanuman. And I have come here because Rama has sent me. And the moment Hanuman says that Rama has sent me, he sees that Vibhishana's eyes are moist and they are shedding tears. He is so happy and he exclaims, he says, oh God, what a great day this is. What a happy day this is. I am so thrilled. A better thing could not have happened for me today. And hearing this is encouraging even for Hanuman, because Hanuman feels that, you know, this is nothing but the grace of Rama. Just imagine, in the whole kingdom, there is just one person who is going to be helpful to me, who is going to be positive towards me, and Rama ensures that I land up exactly at this home. I think this is a message for all of us to take home, that when truly we are in Ramakarya, when we are doing Sai Karya, when we are engrossed in our Lord's work, however rare, however difficult a resource might be or help might be, Swami will ensure in what could possibly be a very amazing coincidence or an accident or whatever, but Swami will ensure that we meet the perfect people, we meet the perfect circumstances, and everything will be taken care of, because as we said in the beginning, it is not our task to be done, it is the Lord's task. The Lord knows how to complete His task and get it done. We just happen to be instruments, and therefore as instruments, without fear or worry, we should plunge ourselves in doing the Lord's work.
Right, and this is, I think, a sign for most of us. A lot of devotees experience this. They set out on doing something. When you come across a devotee of Swami, when you come across a picture of Swami on somebody's car, the kind of thrill it gives you and that enthusiasm which fills you with, that's precisely what Hanuman feels here. He goes here, imagine the first person you encounter, the first building you walk into, is somebody who is so devoted, and you don't even expect that. It's not that you walk into Lanka expecting a devotee of Lord Vishnu to be there. And he finds Vibhishana, and then he reveals his identity.
And you know, we were speaking about this kind of surrender that Hanuman has. He's not bothered about what happens, because everything happens as per his will. That is the same kind of feeling that even Vibhishana has. Hanuman is able to see so many commonalities between him and Vibhishana. Because Hanuman asks Vibhishana, sir, how is it that you are living in such a place that is full of fears, that is full of, you know, it's such a vile atmosphere over here. It's not good at all. How is it that you are able to live over here? And Vibhishana says, I am doing it only sheerly by the grace of God. Because there is, you know, there is no escape. We have been given a body, we have a life, we have to live our life. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, action is inevitable. You have to act, you have to live. But he says, when I am doing that, I am not foolishly thinking that I am the one who is living, I am the one who is acting. Because the Lord is the master of everything. He is the one who animates us, He is the one who makes us do whatever we are doing. And if it is His will that I live here, it will be possible. And He gives the analogy also. He says, have you seen the tongue? The tongue is surrounded by 32 teeth which are constantly trying to catch it. And yet, when you speak, You hardly, never you will be biting your tongue because the tongue is able to escape all the 32 teeth. How is it able to do it? In the same manner, O Hanuman, when the Lord has decided to place me here, just like the tongue is protected from the teeth, I am also protected from everything. It is only the grace of God. And hearing this again, Hanuman is happy because this is a common bond they share where they credit everything to the grace of God.
And in another discourse, Swami makes this point, you know, when you said about this tongue and teeth.
Mm-hmm.
At a point when Vibhishana is very despondent in this conversation, he says, you know, I'm stuck up here like this. Apparently, Hanuman tells him, you know, Swami says this in the discourse. Hanuman tells him, don't worry, Vibhishana, the teeth fall off first. The tongue never falls off. So just persevere and it's a matter of time and, you know, you become the ruler. And Hanuman, of course, reveals his identity. He says, I'm come here for this task. And another conversation which happens at this point, which probably is not highlighted in the Ramkatha Rasvaini, but Swami would tell many times later. Mm. You know, Vibhishana is in awe of Hanuman because he's saying that, you know, I am also a servant of the Lord. Even I keep chanting the Lord's name.
In fact, you know, that is exactly what Vibhishana says.
Right, after this conversation.
He falls off at the feet of Hanuman. And he says, you know what, Hanuman, you have come from Rama. I am also yearning to see him. But what is it that I am lacking? I think I lack the virtues to see him because I have not had his darshan even once. What can I do if I was born into this demonic tribe? What can I do if I was born in this city? But I am also constantly taking his name. See, that is another commonality between Hanuman and Vibhishana. Both are constantly chanting the name of the Lord. So he says, I am doing Ramanama. Why am I not yet blessed by Rama? Will I ever be blessed by Rama?
And of course, he says that, you know, probably just being born in this land, I don't deserve it. And, the family I'm born in does not warrant me to get this blessing of having the darshan of the Lord. Then Hanuman says, you know, very beautifully, Hanuman says, Vibhishana, I mean, I'm the best example for you. You know, I'm a monkey. And he says, even the Vedas and Vedanta, if they want to depict fickleness, they talk of the monkey.
Hmm.
You know, that's how much I have become synonymous with instability and fickleness and, you know, all the qualities which you don't want in a human mind.
Especially in a spiritual aspirant.
Right, especially in an aspirant, especially in a devotee. And I am coming from a monkey. I mean, that's my birth. But even me, Hanuman, Rama has accepted. Isn't that a perfect example and sign that he does not see anything else but just that purity within, just that love inside? So he said, you have it and that's all that matters. And as I was saying, that it's not mentioned in the Ramkatha, but in the later discourses, Swami says this, when Vibhishana says that, but why am I not getting the darshan? So he says, see, you're definitely chanting the name of Lord Rama, but what have you done for Rama? He says, Mother Sita is here in Lanka for so many months. What have you done? What work have you done for Rama? And that's when this beautiful Swami also would love to say this. And he would tell all our students, you know, this is the way you have to live your life. Swami would tell that Hanuman tells Vibhishana that remember this. You should have the Lord's name in your mind and Lord's work in your hand. Man mein Ram, haath mein kaam. Swami said, this is the message. This is what I have been living with. And once you start doing this, you know, you're doing the repetition of the name in the mind. But once you start doing Rama's work, you'll automatically win that little bit of deservedness which you're lacking right now.
Absolutely. In fact, in Sanskrit, Swami would say, it's not enough if you have Rama Nama, you should also be involved in Rama Karya.
Right.
And I think it starts off like that, you know. It starts off with we doing Swami's work. And because we are constantly doing Nama Smarana along with that, it reaches a point where whatever work we do itself becomes the Lord's work. The distinction between my work, office work, home work, Swami's work, all that vanishes. And that is when work truly becomes worship. So, it is not enough if we just do Namasmarana. Along with Namasmarana, there is the need for action. Just like, again, that same analogy comes to mind where Swami says that bhakti, karma and jnana are not three separate paths to the goal, they are like three wheels of a three-wheeler. All the three are needed for the smooth movement of the vehicle. Just that as per our choice, as per our preference, we can choose what is our front wheel. If I want bhakti to be, if I enjoy the bhakti marga more, I can put bhakti yoga as my front wheel, but I need to be backed by jnana and seva, that is karma. And if I choose karma as my predominantly favorite way of sadhana, it definitely needs to be backed by bhakti and jnana and so on. So, this is what Hanuman makes clear for Vibhishana, and Vibhishana then realizes what his mistake has been in pursuing the Lord. I think this is the advice that stands him in good stead later on also. When it comes to making a choice, Vibhishana decides to sever his ties with his own brother and the kingdom that has fostered him to come to the feet of Lord Rama. Because when it comes to the Lord, nothing better stand between you and the Lord. There is nothing more important than the direct contact between you and the Lord. And it is because of Hanuman saying like this, Vibhishana realizes. And as we shall see later in the war also, he does so many things for Rama, going against his own little individual identity.
Very true, because you know it's a perfect example of what Swami says of unity of thought, word and deed. No, because here is Vibhishana, who has always been thinking of Lord Hari, is doing Namasmarna. And there are instances where he has advised Ravana against this. He says, no, this is not the right thing to do. Please don't do this. But never was he, you know, bold enough to act on it. Like, you know, he has spoken about it. He has kind of expressed this one. But, you know, still he is there. Still he is in the court. Still he is trying to, save his position in that family, in that royal court. But this interaction is what makes him take that final step of unifying the thought, word and deed. Because many of us face this, you know, we know that something is wrong. We have probably speak about it in places where it does not matter. But when it comes to acting on it, we are a little hesitant, because you're throwing in a lot of things at stake when you have to act on it. But Swami says, you know, like I think the 2 weeks back when we spoke about Swami's definition of satya in one of the qualities aspirant has to develop. Swami says it is nothing but the ability to speak and act as in accordance to the conscience. And that's precisely what Hanuman is final push which Vibhishana wanted. And as you said, the kind of sacrifices that he does when it comes to the battle, when it comes to later, is phenomenal, because you know most of us are just that little bit of nudge is what is required, and who better than Hanuman to do that for Vibhishana?
In fact, it starts right away, because Vibhishana tells Hanuman, "You be careful. There are these guards that are patrolling, so be very careful." He advises him and also teaches him the routes in the city which are safe to take and all that. And Hanuman is. You know, he doesn't want to delay even for the sake of Vibhishana. It's not as if you can delay the Lord's work for a apparently good cause also. So he continues searching, and Hanuman tires out in his search, because wherever he goes, he can't believe that this can be Sita. Right. He sees through mansions.
And he's not had food also, because the Swami mentions that Vibhishana offers him refreshments which he refuses. He says that till I meet Mother Sita and console her and pass the message I'm supposed to give to her, I can't eat or drink anything. That's the vow I've taken. And, you know, the enthusiasm in which Hanuman goes, instead of stopping and asking Vibhishana, where can I find Sita? He says, no, I have to find Sita, and he runs away. You know, had he probably stopped and asked Vibhishana, he could have gone straight to Mother Sita. But in that enthusiasm, he starts going around. And as you said, this is something which, again, an incident which Swami would highlight, especially for Swami's students. And he would say, here is Hanuman. He is a sworn brahmachari. Right? He is the one who is celibate. And he is having to go into Lanka and look for Mother Sita. And whom does he encounter? Hordes and hordes of women who are not of good character, who are involved in, you know, licentious activities. You know, here is somebody who is a celibate, would try to avoid such scenes, avoid looking at women like this. But here is he's doing Swami's work, he's doing the Lord's work. Even if it means that he has to go into this, you know, that is why the mind control is so important for a devotee. It's not just keeping yourself away from bad company, but the ability to go right into bad company and still remain pure.
Not get affected by it.
And that's what Hanuman embodies.
It's like that example that Swami gives of the fence around the sapling. When we are tender in the spiritual path, we need that protection. And that is when I feel keep away from bad company literally applies, where you avoid bad company. But as you grow into a tree, Swami says, when the tree becomes big, it shatters the fence because the trunk becomes so thick. And the same goats and buffaloes against which it had to be protected, the tree becomes a resting place for the same buffaloes and goats. So in the same manner, once you grow spiritually to the level of Hanuman, it so happens that avoid bad company assumes a new meaning. It means you avoid the bad in any company that you go. Whichever company you go in starts becoming good company, because the goats and buffaloes, instead of nibbling at your leaves, they come and take shelter under your shade. That's what happens. I feel that is what happened with Swami also. You see, many times I'm sure we would have wondered, especially those of us who have stayed here physically for a longer time, we look at people and pass our own judgments, think that, you know, this person is not such a good person, this fellow is a wicked person, this fellow is a fraud, this fellow is this, and yet everyone was welcomed and love showered on them by Swami. It's amazing. Means people whom we will not even feel like looking at in our own judgment, we feel that they are so bad. Even such people receive grace from the Lord, because I feel it is like that goat and cattle analogy, where Swami, of course, it's not that he reaches the level. Swami is the ultimate goodness and purity, because of which, for him, avoid bad company is to avoid bad in any company that he is. And he is able to see only the good parts of every person. And that is what even Hanuman is able to do, and that is why he is not affected. So, avoid bad company, I feel, holds different meaning for us depending on what level we are. At a beginning stage, yes, avoid runaway. Because, you know, I used to also think that if all of us avoid bad company, who will help the bad people? You know, how will they become good? So, till we reach a point where the bad in them cannot affect us, yeah, we have to run away from them. After that, in their presence, our behavior, our attitude, the way we speak, the way we think, the way we radiate positivity or goodness will be such that in our presence, even the bad will not be able to express the bad. Therefore, the bad is being avoided in whatever company we keep.
Once I think we spoke about it, generally bad has this tendency of wanting to draw good and make it bad, but there will be a certain, you know, amount of even whom we call bad or wicked who will try to seek your company because you're good. You know, this is good company, let me seek it. I think when that happens, even that bad company is, you know, we spoke about Christmas earlier. There's that episode where, you know, there is a woman of ill repute in a town who comes to Lord Jesus. You know, every other person says, you know, don't go to her. She's a, you know, don't go to her house. She invites Jesus to her home.
She's a prostitute.
Right, she's a prostitute. And, you know, Jesus says that, you know, she is coming to me in seeking the goodness that I am expressing. It's a completely different thing. As you said, you know, when the cattle come to the tree which is no more in danger from the cattle. It's almost like that when you're able to grow yourself so good that you become a good company and no bad company is bad enough to be bad company for you. I think till then, run away from bad company works. And Swami would say that, see, this is the level of, you know, mental stability you have to reach. Not that endlessly you keep avoiding it. Finally, the goal of the whole thing is, even when you're in, as Swami would say, like the lotus, which is in the dirty water, but the water can never, never dirty the lotus.
I feel it's like, you know, like you, if you are, say, a white bar and you have a thin plastic covering on you, you avoid things that can rip the plastic cover and dirty the bar. But if you're a white bar of soap where every atom in you, every part, every molecule in you is good, you know, a soap touches however dirty a body, the soap is not going to get dirty, it's only the dirty body that's going to get clean. So, that is the level at which Hanuman is, and that is why he's able to look through the whole of Lanka, go through, sort through women, and then tick them off saying, no, this is not Sita, this is not Sita. So much so that so much time passes, and Hanuman in his enthusiasm to serve the Lord, as you said, has forgotten, and he has forgotten to ask the location of Sita, and he's almost on the verge of dejection because he's thinking, oh God, what is it? How can I go back to Rama? Having come so close, how will I show my face to Rama? I think it's better that I drown myself in the sea.
Right.
And I feel this whole thing is also a divine drama that the Lord enacts in order to give Vibhishana that opportunity to start doing Rama Karya, start acting for Rama, because this is the point in time when Hanuman is again passing by Vibhishana's house, when Vibhishana calls and tells Hanuman, listen, Sita is here. There's a place called Ashoka Vatika, Ashoka Vana. It's a forested area. That is where she is. In fact, you know, I have sent my wife and daughter to give her company so that when you're surrounded by Rakshasis and ogresses, it's good that you have a couple of people who will be sympathetic towards you, who will lend a sympathetic ear to you, who will empathize with you, feel the way you feel, and also encourage you with the Lord's name. Therefore, I have sent my wife and daughter. I think his wife is Sarama and daughter is Trijata. I have sent them to take care of Sita. So that is how Vibhishana starts, you know, doing Rama's Karya, sending his wife and daughter there. Apart from that, also guiding Hanuman how he can reach Sita. And that is how Hanuman starts going towards Sita.
Right. And the other thing which probably in other discourses Swami mentions is, you know, Hanuman goes around looking for Sita like this, and then he says, you know, what am I doing? No, from the description of Mother Sita which Lord Rama has given me, she can definitely not be among these, you know, because all of these are living in palaces. In fact, I think in the Valmiki Ramayana there is that episode of he entering the house of Mandodari, the apartment of Mandodari where
Ravana's wife,
and she is also a very, very pious woman. She is, Swami would say that she is one of the Pativratas of in the ancient scriptures. So he sees such a glow on her face, and for a moment Hanuman thinks that maybe this is Mother Sita. Because here is a woman who is not like the other women, who is, you know, there's so much of effulgence on her face. But then he says that, no, this cannot be Mother Sita, but because she will not even accept this much of comfort. You know, being away from Rama, knowing that Rama will not enter a city, knowing that Rama is, you know, living such a frugal life. Definitely Mother Sita will not be in a palace like this. So he rejects even that. He says, no, this cannot be Mother Sita. And of course, then he goes to this Ashokavana, where he finally comes face to face with Mother Sita.
What happens in Ashokavana before he actually converses with Mother Sita is something interesting, because as he's going to Ashokavana, he's also seeing that this Ashokavana is in one corner of the city. It's away from everything, and that is why he has actually missed it in the first place. But even as he's going there, he sees that there's a magnificent procession that is also headed towards the Ashokavana. What is this procession about and what happens? I think we will take that up after this little break.
Thank you.
Welcome back, dear listeners. And yes, as we heard that bhajan on Rama Sevaka Hanumanta, Hanuman has reached Ashokvana. He's sitting on a tree and he's watching what's happening below. He sees that there is one woman in this beautiful garden which is shining, which is fantastic. And she's sitting under a tree and she's weak and worn out. It looks as if she has not had food, she has not had sleep. And Hanuman somehow feels that this lady, you know, matches Sita's description, because that is how forlorn Sita will be. A thing that adds to his conclusion is the fact that there are these demonesses, ogresses, rakshasas sitting all around her. Some of them are threatening her, trying to force her into doing something that she is possibly not wanting to do. At the same time, as I said, you know, Hanuman sees that there is one cavalcade that is coming in. It's a magnificent procession. There are women who are dressed very beautifully and decked with ornaments, but they are also holding plates full of jewels and ornaments and riches, and they are heralding the great demon Ravana. And Ravana is coming and deciding to make his entreaties to Sita's. This is what Hanuman observes.
Right, and he comes in with this huge retinue of maids and people who are all carrying all kinds of gifts for Sita. And he goes on to say again, you know, he's trying to win her heart. He starts by pleading for her love and then he starts threatening her. And finally, I think he says that I give you 1 month's time. There is no way your Rama is going to come into this place and, you know, save you. Don't ever think that that's going to happen. I'll give you 1 month's time. And I think Swami doesn't write it so descriptively, but there are places where it said that if you don't concede, you'll be eaten up by the same Rakshasis who are guarding you. No, that's how he threatens Mother Sita.
And you know, Sita's vow of chastity. Sita believes that only Rama has right over me, no one else has right. I think when she says that statement, we should again look at the metaphorical meaning. Sita is Prakriti. Nature says that only God has right over me. You humans, all of you, you are living because of my bounty and grace. You don't have a right over me. I have a right over you. And the minute you change the equation, disastrous consequences you will have to face, just like Ravana is about to face for trying to, you know, lay claim and rights over Prakriti, which is Sita. And so, such a great Pativrata Sita is that she doesn't even address Ravana looking at him directly. She, in fact, it has been glorified in many of the televised serials also, where she plucks out a blade of grass and she speaks to the blade of grass. It is almost like Sita is communicating with the grass and Ravana happens to overhear. And you know, Sita cries out to the blade of grass, says, "This fool, the vile, vicious fellow." He is not able to realize that only Rama has rights and none other than Rama can have any right over the body. If it comes to that, I shall reduce my body to ashes in the flames of my sorrow and separation from him. I shall never stray from this resolve. And when she speaks thus, even the great Ravana, who strikes terror and fear in the hearts of so many around, he doesn't have the courage and confidence to just come and hold this woman. This is a woman who he held by the hair and kidnapped. But now seeing, actually now Sita is in a much more weak form. She's reduced to a skeleton and she's just sitting all by herself. And it's not even a foreign land, it's Ravana's own kingdom. He's surrounded by an army of demons and demonesses. And yet this Ravana doesn't have the courage to lay a finger on Sita. Now I think that speaks about the courage and fearlessness that the protection of the Lord gives.
Very true, and that is also the way a devotee responds, you know. We all have devotion to God. We all feel like, you know, as we spoke about Sugriva, when you speak, how that emotionally you kind of pledge yourself to the Lord. You want to do something. You want to surrender your life. You want to live all your life at Puttaparthi and all those kind of things.
Mm.
But when faced with a problem, when threatened, you know, forget being threatened. Temptation is enough for us. You don't even have to be threatened. But, this is what Mother Sita is teaching us, that when you have decided that my entire life is for the Lord, when even threatened for life, you don't binge. You say, you know, this is where my loyalties lie. And this is what Swami wants all of us to be like. You know, it's not saying that, "Swami, I will do whatever you want. Swami, I will live for you." When there is no challenge, to be able to hold on to that when there is a challenge, when there is a temptation, and when, you know, taking the other route seems to be more pleasing than this one.
Exactly. And when Sita says like this to Ravana, Ravana is, of course, he's disappointed, he's angry, he's frustrated, and as you said, he gives that 1 month deadline, otherwise she'll be eaten up by the same ogresses. But nothing seems to make even the slightest dent on Sita. And Ravana then walks away. No, the whole retinue turns away and Hanuman is observing Sita and he sees the same Sita who stood so brave, who was unmoved, who was untouched by anything and who seemed like Goddess Kali herself, 1 moment back, is now breaking down. She's breaking down and she's looking towards the heaven and she's saying, "Oh Rama, has not compassion yet entered your heart? Why do you condemn me to this torture? When will I be freed from this? Why don't you come?" And this is another beautiful thing. That is, I feel this is the two sides of the devotee. When it comes to standing for the Lord, nothing can move him. Nothing can touch him. But when it comes to weeping for the Lord, even the slightest of thing is enough to move you into tears. This beautiful paradox exists in a devotee. This beautiful two sides exists, and that we are able to see in Mother Sita also.
You know, I have come across some devotees who say that they've gone through very, very difficult times in life, but they're very, very strong. But you mention Swami's name, you tell something about Swami, or even the very fact that physically Swami is not here, that is enough to make them just break down and cry. And they would say this, "Tears are only for Swami. You know, I will not cry. Problems cannot make me cry. Tears only for Swami." I think that's precisely in this one moment Mother Sita is showing us that beautiful quality of a devotee.
Dear listeners, what happens next again gets more interesting, but I don't think we will have time to go into that today because the time in our studio is already 1:58. So we will leave you with this thought, that as a true devotee, we have to stand resolutely firm for the Lord without budging an inch, without shedding a tear. But when it comes to crying for the Lord, the slightest of thing, the smallest of smile, the little glimpse of orange that we get of our Swami should be moving us to tears, because it's such a beautiful experience to cry for the Lord. When we cry for the Lord, we get cleansed, we feel freshened, we feel so strong, we feel so wonderful. With that thought, we will leave you with this song, on the other side of which Brother Chandu, as always, will join you with his segment, Love to Love. We offer this at the lotus feet of our dear Swami and to Hanuman, seeking his inspiration to become like him.
And as we go, very warm and Merry Christmas to all our listeners. Do tune in this evening. We're going to have the Christmas Eve carols by devotees from overseas, from 50 countries. Devotees are participating in this. And tomorrow morning, of course, the Christmas celebrations, you'll have carols by Swami students. And in the evening, again, there will be a program. So do tune in.
You can, and don't forget to watch the decorations. Huh?
Right.
They're mind-blowing.
Okay. They're very beautiful. So dear listeners, this is Prem and Arvind from Team Radio Sai, thanking you for your company and offering our humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet.
Jaya ho Veer.